Well, I'm very excited to be here with Michael Craig Martin in his magnificent apartment and looking at all the prints that we're going to go on a journey together, hopefully. Lovely to see you, Michael.
Very nice to see you.
And we are surrounded by your prints.
We certainly are.
So let's get stuck in. From the Christea Roberts Gallery, this is Making a Mark, the podcast exploring artists and their relationship to printmaking. I'm Charlotte Mullins. I've met up with Michael Craig Martin in his London home, high above the city of London, with incredible views from his floor-to-ceiling windows. His apartment is normally the epitome of cool, modernist design, but today it's overrun with his prints from the last 20 years, which now cover the entire floor of his living space. There are letterpress line drawings and pop-bright screen prints, and a new series of giant prints based on iconic paintings, including the Mona Lisa. We're going to start by looking at Objects of Our Time, a series you did in 2014. Could you describe it briefly and how it came about?
Well, it's a set of 12 prints, each one on a different background color. Each one shows a single object. And all of them are objects that are of our time, are contemporary objects. And for me, these things add up to a picture of what our life is like in the contemporary world. And so I've got everything from paper cup, which is virtually valueless. And there's also a diamond ring. There's no hierarchy of value. I don't care if something is vulgar or something is chic. I don't leave either one out. But that's not a criteria to me. Don't care.
Looking at Michael's prints spread out all around us gives me a bird's eye view of his instantly recognisable style. He draws everyday objects using black lines and fills them with bold, bright colours. On the floor to my left is a print of handcuffs coloured bright yellow. To my right, a cerise bentwood chair and a red microphone with a turquoise mesh. Michael's microphone drawing is also the logo for this very podcast. Occasionally, Michael draws people or paintings by other artists. Always he uses a palette of 12 bright colours. His technique is straightforward, reductive, and yet for over 40 years, this process has allowed him to explore the essence of objects, things like microphones and paper cups that we take for granted.
I think one of the interesting things about Michael's work is that on the one hand, it's just like an instant impression. It hits you from across the room, normally because of its colour, but then it unravels over time as you're looking at it.
You know, a dustbin was never the colour of a dustbin. A shoe was not the colour of a shoe. A telephone was not the colour of a telephone. That is Michael Craig Martin. I don't particularly think it applies to anybody else.
So on the floor in front of me are four works from the series. There are three recycling bins, a mic with no flex, so that's quite a modern development, a toothbrush, an electric toothbrush, and then against a sugar pink background, a green Manolo Blahnik shoe. I'm going to call it for what it is, with a red sole, a high heel, beautiful colour on the actual sole going under it is yellow, black and green on the body of the shoe, and then the telltale sign on the heel, the red inner. I read it as a shoe.
I don't show you what the back of it looks like. How do you even know it's three-dimensional? It depends entirely on memory. And if you didn't already know what these things are, you would have trouble reading the image. 98% of the information that is in a shoe itself, I don't give you, but I call on it. And that's what the drawings do.
It's something very interesting about the object and the image, about the disruption between it. The object is a thing, and the image looks like the thing, but is everything that the thing isn't.
I realized quite early on when I started to make the images was most artists who use representation take representation for granted in order to do what they want. And my thought was to look at representation itself. What is going on here? How does it work? What can you do with it? And that's basically what my work has been about. It's a kind of study of how does two-dimensional imagery work? Because it's so peculiar that we make images of things that don't actually look anything like the thing that we're imaging. And yet, if we draw a shoe, it looks exactly like a shoe, and everybody knows it's a shoe. So you get the presence of the shoe without the shoe.
On one side, he's become inadvertently the chronicler of, you know, contemporary life. But on the other hand, what really fascinates himself is the way that people react.
Print dealer and gallery founder Alan Cristea.
We did a series called Fragments. And what he decided to do was to put as little information as possible about, you know, the objects that he was depicting. So there was I remember a briefcase. You got the hint of the handle of the briefcase, tiny bit of the body of the briefcase, but people had no trouble at all. I mean, they didn't think about it. They didn't ask what it was. They'd say, oh, I really like that briefcase. I mean, it wasn't a briefcase. And, you know, Michael talks a lot, and as do I, about it is not a briefcase, it is a painting or a print of a briefcase. But this is one stage beyond that. This is taking a tiny fragment and allowing people to do the work to instantly think of it as a whole briefcase.
Some of the prints on the floor around us today explore this too. In one, there's the bottom quarter of a corkscrew, a tiny twist of metal, improbably coloured red. But when we look at it, our brains take the cue and construct the entire corkscrew around it. We navigate the world in this way, using our memory banks to conjure whole objects from just a glimpse. The Cubists explored this, painting the scroll of a violin or a few letters from a newspaper, seeing how far they could push representation before it dissolved into abstraction. Michael likewise explores how far he can change a familiar object, altering its colour and scale, simplifying its shape, while still allowing it to be recognised. This is what makes his prints so mesmerising. At first they appear simple, and yet, in reality, they're anything but. They're a conceptual exploration of looking and seeing.
Drawing has been absolutely at the heart of Michael's work now for 50 years, and it actually emerged from a kind of crisis. I'm Ben Luke. I am an art critic and a podcast host for the Art Newspaper. He made a very famous work called An Oak Tree, in which he took a glass of water and put it on a shelf, and beside it had a text in which an artist is in conversation with a skeptic, in which he is arguing that it is not, in fact, a glass of water, but an oak tree. It is an absolute landmark in conceptual art, in a way, a perfect conceptual piece. But it wasn't the beginning for Michael, it was the end. And because of that, he went back to first principles, and drawing was that first principle. And the reason that is the case is because he studied on this very important course at Yale University in the early 60s. And that course, even though he wasn't taught by Joseph Albers, its principles were those laid down by Joseph Albers. And they were in things like basic drawing. And so Michael returned to basic drawing as a way to escape this impasse that he created for himself. And so what he did was he just went back and started drawing everyday objects. And the way that he draws was really crucial, because he's not interested in shading, in creating an illusion of a thing existing in space. He's interested in outline. And in fact, in the very earliest drawings, he's using very fine drawing tape on acetate. So he's taking a kind of personality out of it, which of course is deeply ironic, because one of the things about Michael's work being so instantly recognisable is that he does have a very distinctive style, but he was, again, attempting to avoid style. He didn't want style, he didn't want narrative, and yet these things have emerged into his work.
I draw all the time, and I draw everything I find, everything I can think of. I'm constantly looking for things to draw. My favourite activity is finding something and then drawing it. I have a very limited language, which is just a plain line. It's always the same size line. There's no inflection, no sign of handwriting or anything in it. It's always very simple and always very mechanical looking, but it's as factual as possible. Then when it comes to the color, I allow myself every possible freedom, which is what images allow.
In 1978, Michael began to compile a compendium of images, a lexicon of everyday objects, originally executed in black tape on sheets of clear acetate. Now he draws on a computer, which makes it easier to manipulate scale and add colour. So far, he's drawn upwards of 600 different objects.
But that, you'd be surprised at how many that is. But that's an interesting thing, too, because I thought there would be an infinite number of things to draw, and the fact is they're not. There are quite a limited number of things you can draw, but there are variations.
He uses these original forms as building blocks to create a dizzying number of combinations of objects for use in his prints, paintings, sculptures and installations. Today, he has around 50,000 drawings on his database, and he's still adding to it, still experimenting with arrangements, and always looking out for new objects to add. At first glance, his approach to drawing can seem rather dispassionate, even clinical. He never uses a pencil or paintbrush, for example, and we never see his hand. But he uses this technique to create the quintessential version of an object, the version we hold in our heads, the perfect example of a particular item.
You see, I was drawing things which were mass-produced, and I was trying to recreate a sense of mass production in the drawings. That's why I drew things with the kind of line that I did. I mean, everything we buy is brand new. If it isn't brand new, we don't like it. We like it to be absolutely perfect. Absolutely. Everything we want is to be perfect. We go to the supermarket, we want the tomatoes to be perfect, we want the apples to be perfect, we want everything to be perfect. But that's normal in manufacturing. So I tried to make drawings that were exact reflection of that. So it just seemed obvious to me that that was a way of dealing with the whole question about contemporaneity.
Yeah, it gave you the perfect line.
Yeah.
But you didn't, interestingly, because you're so well known for colour now and your prints just explode with colour as we look at them today. But initially, you were slightly reticent with colour.
Yes, who's afraid of red, yellow and blue? I touched on it a little bit at various times in my earliest work. And then I did a project in Rome, where I painted the walls. But I didn't use bright colours. I used kind of institutional colours. But it was a revelation to me. And the next show I did, I had a gallery in Paris, and the gallery was a typical French gallery where around a courtyard, and there were 7 rooms. And I decided that each room would be a different color. So I thought, what am I going to do? Well, obviously, red, yellow, blue, green, turquoise, you know, the orange, the basic colors. So I painted the rooms, and then I painted one image on the wall of each room. And the response was absolutely electric. I'd never had a response to anything I'd ever done. No way. People loved it. People loved going there. People came with their kids. People wanted to come back and have a look. People were talking about the thing. This had never really happened to me with all the other worthy things I had done. People said, very interesting. I like this. But nobody... No, there was no passion in any of that. And I never quite understood what it was meant by the emotional impact of color. But when you painted a room and you went from an orange room to a green room to a pink room to a blue room, people smiled. And I realized the power then that the color had. And to be honest, I've used color like that and I've used those colors ever since.
He is fascinated by what colour can do and uses colour to add new layers of meaning to his drawings, to play with our expectations or challenge our reading of an object, or simply to make the work come alive. In the prints that surround me, a green suitcase has a red handle, while a kitchen knife has a blood-red blade. Carl André's famous bricks appear in one print coloured turquoise blue. A diamond ring sparkles pink and orange in another.
You know, I've often sat with Michael looking at proofs of forthcoming prints and him saying, oh, I think the orange needs to be, you know, a bit more vivid, or, oh, and I think I made a mistake there. I think those two blues should be identical. But the common factor is they're always intense colours. They're always as vibrant, as zingy as possible.
The flat colour blocks of screen printing and the growing scope of digital offered the perfect opportunity for Michael to translate his drawings into prints. Alan Cristea has been working with Michael since the mid-80s, when Michael was commissioned to create a wall drawing in Tokyo.
And so he did this wonderful image. Then we had a conversation about it, and I said, well, why don't we do a version of this as a print? And that was really the start of it. And of course, making prints suited the way he was working so well. I mean, particularly screen print, and then more and more digital also. And of course, a huge difference has come about through being able to use the computer, because originally when he did tape drawings, I mean, he was having to do everything by hand and it was taking eternity. Now he's got, you know, the computer contains this whole compendium of images of objects that he's built up and which can be reused again and again and again.
When Michael started making his drawings in the late 70s, he had no way of knowing that he was going to be charting the evolution of technology, and yet, inadvertently, that's exactly what he's done. His series of prints called Then and Now, from 2017, engages most directly with the idea of time and technological obsolescence. A series of 8 letterpress prints have 2 drawings, one red, one black, superimposed on top of each other. The red image is one of Michael's original early drawings, a classic telephone with a dial and receiver, for example, and an open book. The black image is a new line drawing of the contemporary equivalent, the rectangular blandness of a smartphone and the blank surface of a Kindle screen. This is the series that we're now looking at in Michael's apartment.
And in that print series, you have a book overlaid with a Kindle, makes me feel quite sad.
Yeah. But then there's also a tape cassette, which, of course, anybody under a certain age would look at it and have absolutely not the slightest idea what it was, when we all had thousands of them. But I overlaid that not even with a CD, but with the symbol of Spotify.
Which doesn't exist.
So it's gone from being a material, a mechanical material object, like a tape, where the tape is passed from one reel to another, which seems incredibly mechanical now, and replace it with something where there's no object at all.
And the one that kind of blew my mind, the filing cabinet, a big, you know, four-drawer filing cabinet, and then a USB stick.
Yeah.
What you do is fun, which is to play with the scale. So the USB stick is actually bigger than the filing cabinet in that print, which I like. But clearly it's a tiny dot compared with that giant filing cabinet.
Exactly. These are the things that say a lot about the changes in our lives and how those changes are reflected in these things.
I look at an old school telephone. I'm 62. My daughter, age 27, will look at an old school telephone in a very different kind of way, with a different set of memories. And then on top of that, or behind, depending which way your point of view is an iPhone, which frankly is a much more boring object.
Louisa Buck is a writer, broadcaster and contemporary art correspondent for the art newspaper.
So one's looking at the difference in appearance, but also difference in association. And again, it's still part of his investigation of how we look at objects, what objects say to us. It's the minimal of means to give the maximum of information. And now he's aware that his work, and indeed the times in which we live, our lifespans, have covered this extraordinary evolution of objects and technology. So his art is now engaging with this, not to celebrate or to commemorate or to make any kind of point. The point is in the eye of the viewer. We bring to it what we will. He just presents this very objective, dispassionate depiction of these two objects from different eras. Old school portable television with its dials and a flat screen in the background, filing cabinet. I can almost hear those drawers clank open and shut, metal filing cabinet with a USB stick on top of it. So, you know, we bring to these things what we will.
When we look at any ancient culture, any culture other than our own, what do we look to? We look to the things that they made, that they used, that because these things articulate how they lived. And I know that some of the things I'm drawing now, within a comparatively short space of time, 10, 15 years, people are going to wonder, what on earth was that? And, you know, that an iPhone? What was that? I don't know. But I don't know which one it's going to be. Some things will, what I've realized is some things sustain recognition, and other things really do just disappear. Disappear.
I've got a little challenge for you. You don't have to do it. In my bag, beautifully branded Michael Craig Martin bag. I have five objects. I would like to invite you, if you had to, pick one of them to draw. Which one would you pick and why? So I'm just going to pop them down here. Okay. So I brought a little tumbler, a lemon.
Yeah.
That feels a little bit left field, that one. My AirPods.
Yeah.
Matches.
Yeah.
And a beautiful cross fountain pen. If right now you had to pick one, could you pick any of those, or is there a reason you couldn't pick any of them?
Well, I can tell you, I've already drawn a lemon. I've already drawn AirPods. And I haven't drawn that pen, but I have drawn a Mont Blanc pen. I haven't drawn the matches. And I have drawn a glass, but that's a particularly interestingly formed glass because it's got channels in the bottom of the glass.
Yeah, it's like a bistro
glass. Glass, yes. Which very difficult to draw in the way I draw because of lines, but that's the one I would draw.
And would you photograph it before you drew it, or would you draw it from life?
I would probably photograph it, so photographing things from different angles and very, very slight differences of angle is absolutely amazing. Everything, I mean, when I do a portrait of a person, I ask the person to just sit down and look at me, and then I take 40 different pictures of them doing exactly the same thing. You know, and I say, you know, lift your chin, too much, a quarter of an inch. I end up with 40 completely different pictures of the person. It is in these very, very small differences of point of view and everything, which an image can sit comfortably.
For three decades, Michael shared his outlook on art with students at Goldsmiths College in London. He was hugely influential as a teacher, inspiring many of the young British artists, including Damien Hirst, Sarah Lucas, and Ian Davenport.
Also, absolutely significantly, with that Goldsmiths generation, they made no demarcation between the different art forms, painting, sculpture, filmmaking. It was all art. And that's the same thing with him. He gets a bit twitchy if you call him a painter or a sculptor or whatever, because actually his works, I mean, his sculptures are three-dimensional images of two-dimensional drawings. The boundaries are blurred. He makes architectural interventions, wall paintings, but they're made with tape, not with paint. You know, so it's always very kind of fluid. This kind of idea of demarcation is not appropriate for him. And that's what he instilled into his students. And that's what's in his art as well. This desire that, you know, you use whatever the best medium possible to express what you want to say. And you don't make hierarchies. As soon as those students turned up at Goldsmiths, they were not treated as students. They were treated as artists. And that was quite difficult for some of them because often the crits were quite rigorous. They were not given special treatment. They were not little kind of artists in waiting. They were there, treated as artists, and had to run with that. So, you know, there's a rigour, there's a toughness, but there's also a tremendous kind of democratic, non-hierarchical view in his teaching, in his art, and I would argue in his approach to everything.
Michael started teaching at Goldsmiths College in the 70s. Julian Opie was in his second year when Michael was assigned to him as a tutor.
He never made himself feel like a teacher. He felt more like an enthusiastic artist who wanted to share his observations and opinions. He seemed engaged himself, not just in what I was doing, but in what he was doing and in the art world. So it felt balanced. Michael was somewhat on the outside of things in the sense that at that time he was using recognizable imagery. And that might sound kind of pretty normal at the moment, but during that period, late 70s, early 80s, using recognizable imagery was kind of out of kilter with the way that things were generally being done at that time. I think Michael probably was having to push against the flow. And I don't mean to be crude, but one of Michael's favorite phrases when talking about feeling intimidated or criticized was fuck 'em, said with a strong American accent with a hint of Irish thrown in. And that attitude was very surprising, coming from a tutor, and very exciting, because it meant don't kowtow, don't worry, just get on with it.
I've judged the Gerwood Drawing Prize with Michael, and it was incredible to see him in action, his eyes picking up on every detail, his mind sharing insights and seeing things the other judges did not. It was a glimpse into what he'd be like as your teacher, highly observant, intelligent and rigorous. In Michael's most recent print series called Past Present, he focused his attention on another art form to rethink famous figurative paintings from history. In doing so, he allows us to look at them with fresh eyes. Las Meninas by Velázquez, Holbein's Ambassadors, Leonardo's Mona Lisa. He studied each one in turn and carefully redrew it in his signature style. He also tackled Seurat's Bathers at Asnières, Piero della Francesca's Flagellation of Christ, Caravaggio's Bacchus, and a lofty church interior by San Radam. Each painting is already well known, but in Michael's interpretation, nothing is quite as it seems, with Seurat's river flowing orange and Mona Lisa's skin turning blue. In these giant prints, each painting is now a riot of colour, with hot pinks and magentas fizzing alongside lime and teal. Here's Ben Luke again.
It's so almost blasphemous to depict these extraordinary things with such apparent subversive intent. To depict that beautifully rendered flesh in Caravaggio's Bacchus as flat turquoise colour seems utterly disrespectful in a way. But of course, there's a lot of love that's gone into these works from Michael's point of view. These are obviously works that he admires, but I think he's thinking about, what do they actually mean for us? You know, what does a reproduction of this image actually represent? And what does fundamentally the original work represent?
So on the floor in front of us, it's the first viewing of this new work based on a Piero della Francesca, The Flagellation. It's a very iconic image by Piero della Francesca. There's it almost split in half. On the left is an open colonnaded room with Christ being whipped, flagellated in front of a column. And on the right, there are three men much larger than Christ standing in the foreground who seem to be having a discussion. And in the original, these figures in the foreground are quite brightly dressed. And the ones on the left further back, the Christ figures, are more muted. They're further away. But in your work, it's almost the opposite. So the figure receding towards Christ is dressed in bright orange, and the figures on the right are in blue and green that we traditionally associate with colours that recede. Can you talk a bit about how you chose the colours for this work? Because it must be very difficult to repaint a work by a famous master.
Well, I mean, I draw the image in exactly the same way I would draw a shoe or a table or whatever. And I just draw it as I see it. And again, it's the line, it's all done with the line. Then the color comes later. And so again, the line is, I'm trying to be as accurate as I can be. Of course, none of the paintings that I am drawing have lines in them. I have to invent the line because there may be a change of one color to another, but artists in general do not outline everything in the way that I do. So I have to kind of create up the line in order to do this. The thing is, what I realize is with the color is that I can alter the emphasis, which you've described. I can change. My idea is to try to make visible something which is in the original, but people don't always recognize. And it's the color, more than anything, that can do that. So in the Seurat, many people are irritated because they think, why did he put in these factories, these chimneys in the background? And of course, they are actually in the painting, but most people don't notice them.
They're right on the horizon,
and he's kind of underplayed them, so you could miss them. They are there, but because I draw everything with the same line, something that's unimportant is given exactly the same treatment as something which is very important.
So the Flagellation by Piero, everything is clear. With the Seurat, although he's a pointillist painter, everything is very clear. But then he rose to the challenge. He thought, I must try this. So he moved to two artists who are all about enigma, shadow, what have you. And He found it incredibly difficult, incredibly time-consuming, because the Mona Lisa doesn't have any lines. You know, the Caravaggio doesn't really either. The Holbein is so full of detail. The challenge was, can I deconstruct these images and reconstruct them in a contemporary medium successfully?
Is there something, almost a photographic eye that you're giving to looking in this way? That when the camera was invented, people were horrified that certain things were revealed to the world that were never seen. And it's a similar, that you're being honest to what is actually there.
I think I'm being very honest about what's there. And I think there are things that one misses. I mean, the thing that's famous as a kind of extraordinary aspect of the of Holbein's ambassadors is the skull in the center, which can only view correctly from a side. But actually, the most interesting thing and the most extraordinary thing in the picture is that right in the very top left corner, a tiny sliver of the curtain is just pulled away a tiny bit, in which we see the crucified Christ. I mean, it's such an amazingly potent thing. And you can see that painting many times and barely, you can see it without ever noticing.
Because there are two finely dressed ambassadors to Henry VIII's court.
Who are glamour, and they're surrounded, between them, they have every beautiful object of the world at that time. They have books and globes and musical instruments, and they've got everything, and they're both lavishly dressed, and the floor is fantastic. Everything is fantastic. There's just this plain curtain behind them, and just in the corner, there's this wonderful thing.
It's almost like a vanitas.
In my picture, you can hardly miss the...
Yeah, the curtain is bright pink, but Christ is green, lime green.
Yeah,
he's asserting his presence from the cross.
Exactly.
Seeing these prints for the first time in Michael's apartment, I was knocked out by their sheer scale and ambition. Here's an artist now in his 80s creating some of the most conceptually complex and joyously colourful prints he's ever made. The ambassadors with electric red and green beards. Yes, please. A turquoise Mona Lisa against a lunar landscape. Why not?
By using the colours that he has in the combinations that he has, he's going back to his course at Yale and the colour relationships that he learnt in those classes that were based on Joseph Auber's ideas. And he's saying, what happens if you put this colour next to this colour? What are the effects of it? And what are the effects of it if you put them within the framework of an old master? So it's a curious and very strange project, but endlessly enticing.
The Mona Lisa comes in a whole bunch of different colourways, none of which have anything to do with Leonardo's muddy brown. He's also building on Andy Warhol's legacy here, of Warhol doing all these different colourways of his Marilyn's and his Leonardo's. So it's about image, about form, about colour, about association, about art history, but also abstract, formal, what colour can be made to say and do for each of us individually, and how to, you know, condense these works down to this very recognisable image and give them a new lease of life.
In the mid-80s, after he left Goldsmiths, Julian Opie worked as an assistant for Michael. He travelled to Poland to install a series of Michael's wall drawings, and it was there that he really began to understand Michael's work.
You may remember that series. It's where one object pictorially is placed on top of another, so that the object on the front of that list obliterates to a degree the object behind it. So you get this kind of blob of objects, a globe and a book and a drawer, and I can't remember, a filing cabinet perhaps, something like that. And the process was that in each drawing across the wall, a different object comes to the fore. So it was a visual, I don't mean game in a light sense, but a process with rules. I know now of works that he made before, and I'm very aware of a lot of works that he made afterwards. But that moment seemed very clear, very straightforward, very booming but modest at the same time. They're only thin tape on the wall. They can be gone in 3 minutes. You can pull it off the wall and it's just disappeared. It's gone. And yet it can be as big as you want. And I've taken, I think, a lot from that sense of that sort of approach. And I did recently buy a set of those prints from Alan Christair. If you were here, I could show you.
There's also a print by Julian Opie on the walls of Michael's apartment, and you get the sense that Michael is hugely respectful and proud of his former students. He gives his time generously, just as he has to us today, and I would wager that all those who meet him feel incredibly inspired. Julian still takes inspiration from Michael on a daily basis through looking at Michael's print series, Order of Appearance, which now hangs on the walls of his own studio.
Well, I think I get a sense of energy and an optimism that life, you know, can be enjoyable, can be engaging, can be exciting. That's what I get from Michael's work, and I value that greatly.
You've been listening to Making a Mark from the Christea Roberts Gallery, presented by Charlotte Mullins. To find out more about Michael Craig Martin and the work we've been discussing, please visit www.christearoberts.com.